So what shall we talk about?
What I'd like to talk about is, first of all, when you were in New York in the 60s and you were involved in the whole group with, well, I've spoken to a couple of people who you were involved with, like Carly Schneemann and Yvonne Rainer. And I'm really interested in finding out what you were doing then. I mean, every once in a while there'll be in your book, you know, something or other happened at Yoko's Loft. Mm. And just the kinds of
That'll be a long story, but I'll tell you one thing that I just remembered, in connection with WBAI. I did some girl who was working at WBAI, she was very nice, very intelligent girl, and she suggested that I do just Japanese folk songs or something. And I did four programs. I ended up in doing a series of programs of Japanese folk songs, introducing different folk songs and explaining what the spirit of it is and all that, you know. And it went on for 4 weeks. And that somehow was nominated for the 10 best WBAI program of the year or something.
Oh.
And I thought that was very sweet, and I was very thrilled about it. Well, anyway, those were the days that I was trying to make my living by working in Paradox Restaurant as a waitress, etc. I did just about anything, really, except selling myself. But, you know, I'm fortunate that I didn't have to do that. But, I mean, you know, I just couldn't put myself doing things like that. I'd rather be free, you know, that's it. And I don't know, you might not think being a waitress is freedom, but it could be, you know, spiritual freedom. And, I mean, it's better than having had to do commercials or something. You know, though commercials would get more money, but, I mean, commercial work, I mean,
right.
To, you know, bend your artwork into something commercial. And, well, that's, I was a purist, that's how I thought about it. Maybe I was a snob, but, you know, it's that. And so in those days, I would be doing concerts and things like that. And I had to think of ways of living so that I don't have to, you know, so that I would spend the least money on living. So the first thing, you know, is the apartment. In an apartment, you use a lot of money on paying your rent. So I became a superintendent. And that way you get a room free, of course. And I was living in the village, some, you know, beautiful, comfortable apartment I got for it. One room and a half with nice kitchenette and everything. I was very pleased with it. And, you know, I'd be sort of preparing for my concert or something like that. And then one day I forgot to burn the incinerator. You know, the people sort of throw all the garbage in one, you know, sort of little tube kind of thing that's going through the center of the building, and you have to burn it every day, otherwise the garbage is going to fill it up and all that. And because I had a concert at Carnegie Recital Hall and I was very busy, and that night of the concert I forgot to burn the incinerator. So I had a good review on the Carnegie Recital Hall concert, but something occurred to me in 2 days that I didn't do that. I started to burn it and became a big fire, and I was, you know, I was really terrified, and the fire engine was coming and everything, and it wasn't bad, you know, it just sort of, it didn't go to the point of becoming a big fire or anything. It just started to smoke, that's all. But the smoke went through the whole house, and I was fired as a superintendent.
So you had a good review,
like that.
But no apartment.
Right.
What was the concert?
The concert was a concert of music of the mind, which is a concert of music, but you don't have any sound at all. The sound is all in your mind, and people communicate with each other by making sound pictures in their mind through the kind of thing that I present on the stage. Or present around the concert hall, rather, you know. But the things that I do there that sort of lead people into bringing some musical ideas in their mind.
Like,
know?
What kinds of things would you be doing?
Well, things like I'll be in a bag, you know, and sort of moving inside the bag or something. Or the cut piece, which was sitting on the stage and asking people to come and cut my clothes off, you know, wherever they want. And they would come and just cut a piece of it and go back with it. And that is a pretty sort of scary piece because, you know, in the end you would be naked because, you know, you would cut, they would just take off all your clothes. And also when you have a pair of scissors in your hand, you know, and you're cutting you know, so close to a woman's body or something happens, you know, the arrogance comes out and everything. And sometimes there was a time that I did this piece that somebody was trying to do this, you know, which is to, you know, put, you know, the scissors in a stabbing form, you know, like that position. And I was, you know, scared. But things like that. I think Charlotte Mohmann, you know, the famous cellist, he was a sort of a classic cellist who was studying Juilliard School of Music when I met her. And in that field, she was very famous already. And also, she was famous for a good producer. And I asked her if she would mind producing my first Carnegie Recital Hall concert. And she said, well, I never produced an avant-garde concert, so I don't know if I could do it and all that. But reluctantly, but she said it's all right, and she accepted. Because she was known already as a brilliant producer. I was very, you know, happy that I got her. And she did a marvelous job of it. But that's how she got into the avant-garde field, you see. And now, after that, she was turned on with my grateful book, etc. And she's going around everywhere in the world, touring and, you know, performing pieces of Cage, you know. And she always included my piece for Sentiment or something. Even when I was sort of down, you know, she remembered me as the first one who, you know, gave her a chance, whatever. So she was including my cut piece. And each time she does it, you know, she had experiences like somebody, you know, sort of scratched her skin with a scissors or something, you know, things like that. So she had scary experiences doing that piece. But so when I was in the village, I'd be working sometimes. I went to Bitter End, Monday night, dark night, you know, they had this scene where anybody can come and sing. I did that bit, and I was trying to sing a song and get some money for it, you know, just food or something, in another restaurant called, I just forgot the name, but it's a Greek restaurant that was in the village. And the fellow who was sort of operating was very nice and let me sing there. I was singing, and then this girl, Anne, somewhere, I forgot, who was working WBA, happened to be one of the customers there, you know, eating that night, and heard me singing. She said, it's beautiful, and would you mind, you know, doing it in WBI? And all sorts of things like that. It was very, you know, interesting. I had about 50 different jobs, you know. The Japan Society gave me jobs like go to some university and perform Japanese folk art. You know, that die quick, you know, thing, you know, dying things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
By tying it, you know, what you call
tie-dye.
It? Tie-dye. Yeah, tie-dye. I taught flower arrangements, tea ceremonies, Japanese calligraphy, Japanese poetry, just about anything Japanese, you know, folk art. I never learned Japanese dance, and one day I got a call from Japan, so they said, well, look, can you dance? So I said, oh, yes, of course I can, and I immediately start to, you know, look up the book. I was like that, what was that book about, not impersonator, what was the word for it? I forgot. But, you know, this guy that was disguising in about 10 different people, you know. It was a book about a con, really, you know. But a guy who went to school and suddenly said he claims that he's a teacher of French or something. He doesn't know any French. And he studies, you know, the night before and he can teach. And he was brilliant that way. But when I read that book, I thought, well, it's like me, you know. And he even operated on people, you know, as a doctor. And it was a perfect operation, you know, things like that. But, I mean, you have to be, you have to be something, a bit brilliant to become a brilliant con, too, you know. But, I mean, it's not a matter of conning, but I really sincerely felt that I can do it, you know. And the Japanese folk things that I taught, I tried to tell the spirit of it more than the demonstration, the actual demonstration. You know, may not have been good. But I didn't think that it was bad. I thought of it in terms of, no, I can do anything, and I can show the spirit of things, so it doesn't matter, you know. It was like that. So maybe my Japanese dance was not very orthodox, but I, you know, I did communicate something to people. So those were the things I was doing then. And then I had a loft that, well, I didn't have a loft, actually. I was looking for a loft one day, and I got this marvelous loft that was for $50.50 a month. And that was in Chambers Street, 112 Chambers Street. I'll never forget it. And the night that I was going to get the loft, or not, maybe not getting that loft, I couldn't sleep. You know, the next day I went to the 50 docks and said, please get me this loft. And everybody was after that loft because it was so cheap and it was good. And the reason why I wanted to get that loft was I had an apartment in Amsterdam Avenue, so I didn't need it. But I felt that the kind of work that I'm doing, nobody's going to really give me a concert. No producer's going to ever give me a show or gallery show or anything because it was too far out. So I felt that there was, you know, well, there are some people who are doing things like that, mainly for myself, but I thought for my friends and for myself who do too far out work, you know, that I should get a loft and start a concert there. Why not, you know? And I don't know of any loft concerts that had been, you know, done in the village before that. I think it was probably one of the earliest ones, you know. Somebody might come up and say, well, I did it in 1950 or something, but that was 1959.
What kind of artists were you working with?
Well, I think this was already mentioned in Rolling Stones. I have to look up the list because I don't want to exclude any names, you know. You know what I mean? When I start to exclude names, that, you know, will hurt my friends, etc. But you would know Bob Morris, Ray Johnson, Lamont Young, who else is Jackson McLaw, Darren Wachowski, all the sort of, you know, people like that. Well, I didn't know them then when I was looking for loft. And then one day, a friend of mine came and said, listen, I know you're looking for loft, but these guys are looking for loft too, to do the same kind of thing. And they are asking if I wouldn't mind if they join me doing it. And what they would do is they would paint the loft for me. You know, that's their contribution, because my loft was, you know, beautiful, huge loft, but it was just all gray and dirty. So they said, I wanted to have it painted white. White was my thing, since then. They said, well, I want the whole place to be white. And they said, all right, I'll do that for you, so please let us join. So I said, well, that's fine. And those were the people at Jackson McLaw Lamont Young. Those people joined me.
But what kind of thing, what kind of performances were you giving? Or,
well, for instance,
ideas you were working on then?
Yes, well, you see, it was very interesting. We were lucky, but I don't know, somehow we got a lot of people coming there. Like 200 people in the loft was, you know, a pretty much of a crowd. And when I went into the loft, I couldn't pay for the electricity, so I had a little thing out, you know, in the hall, and I got the electricity out from the hall. You know, the first day I couldn't even do that trick, so I had a candlelight, etc. And all the concerts were done under candlelight until I get this thing done. It was very nice. And then I didn't have any chairs, and people brought me what you call those boxes, you know, that you put apples and things in. You know, crates, yeah. They brought me those, and there were so many crates that I thought, oh, I can make a bed out of it too. So at night I just collect the crates and make a bed out of it, and in the morning I just sort of, you know, it was very functional. And those were the chairs. And I had a beautiful table that I made out of a door, and all these poets just sort of wrote on them, you know, or wrote on the table. And it became a very priceless table. I don't know where that is now. It just disappeared. And then people used to just bring me things, you know. Like I didn't have a heater there, and somebody brought me a heater. And somebody brought me an old typewriter, you know. The whole living was made on something like that.
So it's like a whole artist community then?
Well, no. I was the only one who was living in that loft. My artist friends all had apartments elsewhere. And this was 112 Chamber Street. The loft there was the only loft at that time on Chamber Street. So, you know, like cops will come at night and say, well, I saw a light and I was wondering and all that. And they were nice to me. They were protecting me because I was the only girl who was living around there. And they knew I was living. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't supposed to live there. So I was, you know, telling them that, well, look, I was working late and that's why I stayed tonight or something. But the cops were pretty nice about it, you know.
But I'm interested in knowing what were the ideas, you know, the artistic ideas that you were working on and the interaction between different kinds of artists.
The ideas then was, well, you see, this idea about I want to do something conceptual, you know, and this started when I was in Sarah Lawrence. And you see, I was brought up in a family where most of my uncles and aunts were, you know, they had nothing to do because they were second generation of a rich family or something. So they all became artists, you know, even one of those. And so I was brought up where everybody was painting or, you know, composing or something. And so by the time I was about 18, I had, you know, pretty much sort of thick knowledge of a lot of things in art, but nothing satisfied me somehow. You know, the poems that I write, they thought it was too much like a short story. A short story I write, they thought it was too much like a novel. A novel I write was too much like a short story. You know, a music that I write was too much like a painting. A painting I do is too much like music. And everything was sort of a bit off media, you know, the media that I was working on. And I thought, oh, well, look, this means that the media doesn't satisfy me, so I have to create a new media for some, you know. So in those days, I was just about to go insane because Sarah Lawrence was, to me, it was like an establishment that I have to cope with and I couldn't cope with. I couldn't, you know, put myself to go to regulate myself and to go to classes, you know, as often as they wanted me to, etc. And I was the first dropout, you know, like, I stayed there 3 years, and they didn't want me to, you know, leave just then, because it was silly to leave, you know, after 3 years. So I was doing things like, you know, lighting a match. That piece that in some grapefruit was something I was doing really at home when I was in Sarah Lawrence, but, you know, at the dormitory or whatever.
Which piece is that?
To light a match. Light a match and look at the match just disappear. And I felt that whenever I do that, because the match disappears and I'm still alive, you know, the life of the match is shorter than my life, which was incredible. It was beautiful. And I almost felt that I was going to be a, what you call those people who like to fire?
Pyromania.
Pyromania.
Can you figure out what were the sources of, you know, your inspiration? Had you been reading about Dada painters, for instance, or...
I'm sorry, I wasn't, you know, well acquainted with that. When I was doing something in silence, in composition, musical composition, that's the first time somebody mentioned John Cage, my teacher, composition teacher, mentioned John Cage and said, there's a guy named John Cage who's doing something very similar to yours. I think you would be very interested in his work. So maybe you should go to New York and study with him. At that time, I wasn't interested in studying with anybody because I was a bit more arrogant. You know, I thought I was it, you know, like I can do it. So I said, huh, you know, that kind of thing. And then later I met John Cage. I found his work was very interesting, much more interesting than anybody else's work that I knew of, like more interesting than Berg, Webern, or anybody, you know, that Stravinsky or anything. But somehow I didn't think it was my thing. You know, I still thought that I was more connected closely with what I was doing, which was lighting a match, you know. And it has nothing to do with John Cage's sort of beautiful theory and structure, you know, of whatever he's thinking. So
let me ask you something about the lighting a match. Is that done with an audience?
No, it's not done with an audience. And most of my things are something that is so personal that you don't really have to have an audience to do it. But of course, sometimes, you know, I did it to an audience of 3 people in ceremonies who happened to be my girlfriend, and I would do it, and they would say, so what, you know? I mean, it sounded like a ridiculous thing, but I used to say, this is like acting out madness. And you know that bit about in Snake Bit, you know, that's the old film you wouldn't know, but Olivia de Havilland is just about to go insane, and she goes into an insane asylum where everybody else is insane, and suddenly she realized that she's not insane, she's sane, you know. And that was like all the other people, the insane people, acted out madness for her, you know. But we have to somehow act out our madness in order to not become insane. Now the thing is, in those days, because I was just about to go insane, I really sort of held on to things, you know, like match or something. Or sometimes when I felt really insane, I would just wash my face and just wipe it with a cocktail dress or something, rather than a towel, you know. And just that is sort of like a change of value that I had to do. Because I think it has to do with the fact that I was living in an environment that was so middle class and so much so, you know, strictly so, like you would never dream of wiping your face with a cocktail dress.
Did you then tell people, you wrote down the match, did you tell people what you were doing?
Yes, I was trying to explain to you now about that, that it was acting out madness. But they didn't understand even what I meant then, you know. So what is it, acting out madness, in order not to go insane? It made sense to me because I was going insane. I knew that this helped, you know. So I thought, well, for some people who need that kind of thing, maybe it helps.
I'm just trying to figure out, you see, if you had wiped your face with a cocktail dress and not told anybody, or if you'd wiped your face with a cocktail dress and told somebody, then, you know, which is the work of art and which is the therapy? And is there a difference then?
Oh, that's very interesting. Yes, I understand. No, I was aware that it was something that was going to be a work, you know. But the point was, I was trying to tell you how it derived, you know, and that's how it derived. Most of my work, I do it for my own therapy anyway. So even if I did announce it or not, it was for therapy. But at the same time, most of my work, I'm aware that it's a work because, for instance, from the time that I was born even, you know, it's like I was that kind of person probably. Like when I have this beautiful love between John and I, which is really one thing that I have and I'm very thankful about it. But the immediate thought that I had was, my God, this is beautiful, but we have to tell the world about it. You know, we have to share it with the world. We have to show that this can happen, and this is so good, you know. I mean, this goes into many, many different things. I mean, you know, it's just any time that I saw beautiful, you know, for instance, when I came to America when I was 18 or something, I saw this beautiful sky and beautiful things, and I wasn't very happy because I couldn't share with my friends in Japan, you know. Sharing seems to be the most important thing in my life somehow. Well, not most important, but a very important area of my life, you know. So whenever I find something, discover something that's good for me, I immediately think of telling somebody, you know. And so, yes, it was for my therapy, but what isn't, you know, therapeutic? I mean, most of the painting, you know, like Jackson Pollock, that painting, would you consider that a therapeutic thing for him? Yes, it was, I'm sure. See, anything that is so important to you must be good for you therapeutically as well.
I'm just trying to figure out what then defines a work of art. I mean, do you have
It's still art if you don't show it to anybody, because I'm sure, you know, I know I went through it when I was at art school, you know, I'm thinking, what's the most pure thing, what's the most pure form of artist I can be? And I worked it out that to be the really pure, you know, like people try to be, I'd have to just paint and then either destroy them or not show them to anybody, you know, that would be it. And I thought, well, if I'm not going to do that, anything else is a cop-out. So I may as well, if you're not going to hide them completely, then you have to you're going to show them completely and try and show it as much as you can. So I took that way out. So if you paint, even if it was a painting or a grapefruit piece or a happening that you did on your own, it would still be art, whatever art.
See, Van Gogh's paintings, you know, because it hadn't been discovered then or something, it was considered all therapeutic then, you know. But see, I wanted to tell people, but I mean, nobody wanted to listen, you know. I was a mad woman, right? And just now, these days, you know, when I went into this therapy about the primal scream, you know, they use the same word, which is acting out madness in order not to go mad. And that's what they're doing in their psychology thing, you know. But it happens that I was doing it in art. And then I said, oh, you say that, well, then I wasn't mad then, you know. Because whenever I tried to explain about my art, even when I became a bit famous, you know, like in Japan or in New York, and they said, what is the purpose of your art, Miss Ono, or something? I said, well, that is acting out madness in order not to go mad. And they said, oh, I see. But, you know, they just took it as a mad statement from an artist, you know. They didn't really connect it, you know.
Do you then take it one step farther and, you know, everything that somebody does then is a work of art?
If he thinks that, it is a work of
only
art.
Only if he thinks it.
If
you have,
when
to,
they
you have,
have
to realize what's going on.
Well, if it's fulfilling for them.
You see, you know what? You know what becomes a work of art?
They?
Yes, yes, you're right.
Would recognize it as a work of art.
Yes.
They wouldn't.
You know what a work of art is? Work of art is something that has a value, or as a work of art to somebody, to himself or to other people. You know. So if other people think that it's work of art, it's work of art. Even if one person, if that work of art gave something to him as work of art, then that's a work of art, you know. But anyway, may I go back to the loft days, you know. So what happened within loft days, I was doing something that is an extension of that. Of course, I got the loft for, first of all, to do those things, right? I felt that if I had a place to perform and a place to have people to see what I'm doing, then at least I might get some communication then, you know. So I started to do that. It did work in a way. I think all artists were sort of involved those days in my loft things were very, very aware that they were doing something very important, because they were constantly hassling about credits, you know, like each of them saying, well, this is done by and all that, you know.
I opened that first.
Yes, and right, exactly. So there was that constant hassle, so I know that they knew what they were into. That was very important. I'm very sad. After I went back to Japan, I came back, I saw that people like Andy Warhol, Klaus Ohlenberg, they were much known, much more appreciated. That was good. But some of my friends were doing loft concerts. They were still not very known. I went to London and came back this time. I still see the same thing happening, that, you know, they are not appreciated yet. And I'm very sad about it. But it's not sadness so much, because I think, well, whatever they need, they'll get, you know. So it seems like they really don't want to share their experience artwork with too many people. Maybe that's what it is. But in my case, I'm the opposite. I really like to share whatever I do with as many people as possible. I mean, whatever I do in my artwork, as many as, you know, possible. So in that sense, John and I'm the same. Whenever we write a song, we don't feel that we should leave the song in our closet. You know, we feel that we want to share it with the world. And that's what we're doing. So in the loft days, I was mainly doing that kind of thing. One day I remember that I had a bag of peas, you know, and I was throwing it around, you know, people. This is a sort of a classic Japanese ritual. There's one day of a year when people throw peas, you know, out the house and say, devil go out of the house, you know, and the luck stay in or something, God of luck stay in. And
why peas, you know? What? Do you know why
peas? I don't know. Peas, you know, like rice, it's something basic that people eat, you know. So it's something important for them. I mean, you know, in a very agricultural age, it must have been something very important. But I think, you know, many things that I do in art, I think I adapted from old Japanese folklore, things like that. You know, sometimes unaware of it, sometimes aware of it, you know. But this pea piece, I think probably I did it from that, but I was just throwing it around. And then one of my friends commenting as being too theatrical and dramatic. But, you know, in those days, people used to criticize each other about those pieces very seriously, you know. That, I mean, if I threw a, you know, pee around, probably many people think it's crazy, you know, insane. But among our friends, it was something serious to criticize about, you know, like, well, it's not good, or it's too dramatic, or, well, it should be this way. Don't throw the pee around, but just observe it, meditate, and that's a bit more, you know, or whatever. So they were seriously discussing about little papers and, you know, matches and chairs, whatnot, as artworks. And I was, you know, very happy doing things, but at the same time I shared the same struggle and resentment my friends had, which was the fact that nobody really, aside of a small group, you know, would really care about what we were doing, you know.
You must have had a lot of trouble talking to people who were outside that group.
Well, I wouldn't say, I'm sorry I mentioned that name group, because I think it was more than a group in a sense, you know, because if somebody would have been asked if he was in the group, in the chamber loft scene or whatever, they would say, no, I was an individual, I was an artist, I was doing something unique, you know, so I hate to sort of label them as group, you
know.
Well,
people who were sympathetic to each other, at least.
In a way, right. But I think, sympathetic to each other, and also, you know, hated each other and killed each other or whatever, you know, but that kind of a, but I think these days, I think it's concept art is, I think, starting to get known a lot. It's almost fashionable in the art world, I understand. I don't know why. Now that it's getting that way and everybody's, you know, trying to tell each other I'm the one who first started the concept art, etc., I like to announce here, and you know, that mine isn't concept art, mine is con art, you know. Because somebody, in the beginning, you know, they say, Yoko, you have to label something. You have to give a nice label to your artwork, you know, someday. These sort of art friends are on the art world who think that I'm just sort of disorganized artist and need to be taken care of and, you know, says, well, you better do this. I said, no, I don't want any label in my art. And they came up with this name, concept art, and I thought it was beautiful. Later I found out somebody else had an idea about concept art before that, you know, but I didn't know that. And they said, oh, that's beautiful, but listen, concept art sounds a bit too stuffy. I want con art, you know. And they said, no, don't, you know, you shouldn't make fun of yourself. Then people wouldn't take you seriously either. So I swallowed it and I said, okay, concepts are fine, you know. But now that I think of it, I should have gone ahead and said con art, because there's so many concept artists these days that are claiming the origin of it that I feel sort of guilty to even, you know, use the same name. So why don't they let me say that mine is con art, you know. And that's the most marvelous thing in the world, which is to give somebody a dream, you know. Con is a dream.
So then after you had...
You lost me.
Yeah, I mean, what happened?
Well, that went on for a year, and many people through that, I think, got better chances. You know, like some producer came to see a show in the loft, and suddenly started thinking, well, this is great. So he started the same thing in upper sort of Madison Avenue kind of place. Nicer gallery, etc., and that was done. But he turned out to be a very nice guy, George McCunis, who started the Fluxus after that, you know. And he got the idea from my Chamber Street loft concerts, I understand. But he helped me a lot in doing my first do-it-yourself art show. It was in 1960. It was very beautiful. It was in Agnes Gallery, and he had to close the gallery after my show because he couldn't get any money, you know. Most galleries, whenever they do my show, and after a month or so, they close. So I don't know what that connection is. I did a show in England in Indica Gallery, and that's closed too. You know, things like that. So anyway, so that was very nice. And in the loft scene, I think many of us got a chance to do things in, Carnegie Recital Hall and Judson Hall, you know, finally.
Judson Church?
Judson Hall, that is right opposite to Carnegie Recital Hall. Or Judson Church, I think the Judson Church thing came about after this James Street thing, too. Many things came out of it, you know. And Al Hansen, Philip Corner, those people did the same loft concert series type of thing after I left for Japan. After I did a year of the loft concert, I got fed up. I just stopped doing it because it was starting to become such an establishment, which is amazing. And I just stopped it, and I went back to Japan to do a concert tour. I thought I'm going to only stay 2 weeks in Japan. I ended up staying about 2 or 3 years. And when I came back, I saw many things that happened after the chemistry concert.
What were you doing in Japan?
I was doing concert tours and things like that. But, I mean, you know, in that same fashion, you know, cut piece, bag piece, you know, things like that.
How was that received?
Yeah. I don't know. It's a sort of a mixture of, you know, it's something like if somebody came up to you and said, liking a match is what I do, you know, as an art form or something. You know, it's like that. Nobody took it seriously, really.
Yeah, somebody they would receive it much differently there than they would even in the early 60s here.
Yeah, but you know, some American, because they thought, well, this must be something that's done in America, so let's ask an American to write a review, you know, and they thought that was being kind to me. So they got this guy, an American, who wrote it as a steal from John Cage or something. And it was very strange when John Cage himself thinking that my thing was so different that he didn't want to include me in his party, you know. So it was like that. So they didn't know the difference. And they said, oh, is that what it is and all that? And I was very hurt. Other than that, I think, of course, I was always somehow getting jobs to talk on a TV, etc., for what I am. In the my personal life, you know, in Japan, it was sort of a novelty to find a female artist who was away in foreign countries for more than 10 years or something, and things like that. I was a novelty. In the village, I was a novelty too, and I don't like to be known as a novelty. Now here again, I'm a novelty. I'm a Mrs. Lennon who married a Beatle. You know, it's that. So as John says, probably I'm the most famous unknown artist in the world in that sense. And but, you know, strangely enough, I was always that, you know, always somehow a very sort of people curious about me, you know.
But now you,
for the wrong reason.
You've really reached your fame and fortune by marrying John. It seems. I mean, that you're known not so much as Yoko Ono, independent artist, you know,
exactly,
by yourself,
exactly.
But
that's another thing. Was very. John. You see, I could go into it, but I don't want to at this point because I don't have enough time. But you know, for being a woman, you know, and doing my thing. When I was in the loft, you know, in the loft days, it was very hard for me, especially because I was a woman. Most of my friend artists were all male, and they tried to step on me for being an artist. They wanted to shut my mouth and try to regard me as the owner of the loft who is helping the concert, you know, that kind of thing. And I had a constant fight with one of the members who were active in organizing this thing in my loft, because he tried to really, you know, shut me up, you know. And I was saying, listen, I understand you're a very talented artist. All you have to do is you have to reciprocate that and just, you know, realize that I'm also a talented artist. And you don't introduce the people, you know, critics, that I am this girl, this chick is a chick who owns this loft. Yeah. You don't, you know, say to a reporter, let's go home and talk about it at my place about loft concerts. If it's done in my loft, the critic should come to my loft and ask me questions, you know. He was even going to an extent of writing under the program, any information you would like to know, please get in touch with so-and-so at so-and-so Bank Street, you know, about my loft concert, which was ridiculous. There was constant, you know, thing like that. And so I wouldn't say that, you know, some people think, oh, well, the reason why I was not seriously taken as an artist then, as many of my friends were, was because I was untalented. No, or I was not unique. No, the reason was because I was a woman and they wanted to regard me as, you know, well, she's a woman, so she should shut up there. I had a lot of that, and when I got together with John, I was a very active filmmaker who was making a film that is more than unique, I think, you know. The Bottoms film, I don't know of any other male filmmaker who was making something like that. Also, that my Bottoms film was the first avant-garde film that was played in a West End regular theater, which is an accomplishment for an avant-garde underground filmmaker, which was not done by any male filmmaker.
See, I don't understand that film.
Oh, okay.
I don't understand that film. Is it, is what you want to share about that film is by taking pictures of famous people's asses, you're sort of like bringing them down to everybody, just being,
I was saying it,
having
it's
an
it's
ass
a complicated
like everybody
con. Yeah, it's a complicated con. It's a kind of humor that I want to add in life, which was, I was collecting Bottoms as intellectual Bottoms, and I don't want any Bottoms that was not intellectual. So all these very highly intelligent people came, and they wanted to show their, you know, behinds. But then it turned out that those behinds were no different from, you know, whoever's behind. And I wanted to show that side, that we're no different. You know, where's an intellectual Bottom? You know, show me one. You know, it's that. To rip the snobbery, you know, of whatever middle-class intellectuals have. And especially of men, you know. I mean, men made a big thing out of it.
Yeah, I can really dig it, yeah.
They're the proof, you know. You must know that men encourage us to be very advanced and, you know, swinging and all that, you know. And we are looked down upon for, you know, not taking off our clothes or whatever, being square and prude and all that. But do you know one man who wouldn't mind just taking it off, you know? Because, look, they're prudes like hell, you know? Mm-hmm. They don't mind seeing a woman being swinging, but no, they don't want to be swinging.
And then when you do it, you get raped and they say you were asking for it.
Right, exactly. But the point is, my point is not what the Bottoms film is about or what it was or what value it was. I'm saying that I was doing just as well, if anything, better than any other underground filmmakers that are male, you know? But still, when I got married to John, or I got together with John, I ended up being a Hawaiian actress or something. You know, John Lennon is going out with an actress, Yoko Ono or something. Where does this actress come in? I went to raise money for my next film, you know, on the basis of the bottom spoon I made. I would go to all these producers and they say, oh, are you the girl who performed in the bottom film? They can't think of the fact that a woman can be a director, right? And they try to say, oh, yeah, you look pretty, you know, right? I mean, you perform in a Bottoms film, you know, that kind of thing. And then my ex-husband, who was just assisting to make a film and who had done nothing but just assist that film, you know, Yoko Ono got a divorce from a filmmaker, so-and-so, and Yoko Ono herself is an actress who got, you know, married to John Lennon. I mean, you know, that, you don't do that, you know, to a filmmaker, you know, that kind of thing.
Yoko Ono, wife of filmmaker.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And now an actress, you know, married to John Lennon kind of thing. So I suffered a lot of that, you know. And I think there's still many people they're very male chauvinistic, you know, people in the art world, you know, who's sort of oriented to think that women are nothing, you know, who still claim that, you know, I was having a hard time because I didn't have any talent. I just don't know if somebody who's a male artist who did as much as I did, you know, if they would be considered an untalented artist, you know. I'd just like to know about that.
Do you think that people consider you a serious artist now?
I don't know. I don't really know. I think if they take me too seriously, that's again wrong, you know. But I don't have to worry about that, you know. I'm not in a position to worry that, I suppose. But it's just that I think the role of artist still has a great part in this world because, you know, artists are starting to think, well, art is old-fashioned and they're sort of ashamed and embarrassed of being artists. They don't know what they are and they lost their confidence, etc. But art is the only way that you communicate to people, you know, directly as human to human, you know. And if that art doesn't have that kind of direct communication, then that art is no good, you know.
What about computer art?
Whatever art is supposed to give.
I think, like in your case, and a lot of other women's cases, it was more like she's a cute lady and she has a lot of crazy ideas, but not
right.
That it would take any talent to put over those ideas,
no.
And not that it was art at all. Just a really nice girl and she has some crazy ideas. But
then again, you see, I don't think you need talent to become an artist. I think you need a certain frame of mind, you
right,
know, to be an artist.
Over.
Yes, but I think if you call that certain frame of mind talent, then I understand, you know, that's talent. But I think anybody can be an artist without any technique or anything if they sort of adopt a certain frame of mind. That's all you need. Communication is something that you want to do, and if you realize that you really want to communicate, and if you become desperate about it, then you start to have, you know, necessity brings imagination.
Yeah.
You know, imagination is something, you know, that comes out of necessity. You really need to communicate. Therefore, you start to have imaginative ideas as how to communicate, you know. Imagination is nothing that some people have a lot and the others don't, you know, for some reason or other. You know, it's not like that. Anybody can start to have a lot of, you know, rich imagination if they really realize how desperate they are to communicate. And I think if the whole world starts to communicate a lot, what happens is total communication equals peace. I really believe that. You see, when
what
you
do you mean by total communication?
Yes, total communication equals peace. That is, you see, violence is something. Violence is an emotion that we feel when we can't communicate, when somebody doesn't understand me, when somebody doesn't appreciate me, when somebody ignores me. That means that somebody does not love me, you know? Then I become violent. You see this little boy saying, mommy, mommy, mommy. Mommy doesn't answer. He starts to hit mommy. That's the first violence, okay? So violence will disappear as soon as we can communicate, you see? And that if the emotion of violence is not around, there's no violence, and there'll be peace, naturally. So if we would totally communicate, if the whole world would totally communicate, there's no point of violence because violence would not occur. So I think of an idea of utopia for me is a world that everybody has their own freedom, you know, completely, complete freedom, total freedom for everybody. Now, that sounds ridiculous because many people still believe that if we give freedom to people, people are going to be violent, people are going to be bad, you know. That's wrong, you know. Initially, maybe there's some big hassle, you know, because we have so many pent-up emotions and all that, you know. But in the end, it would balance it off. If we are, you know, sort of set free, we're not going to start to harm ourselves or anybody else. You know, there's no reason for it.
But how do you, how do people communicate totally? How do you start to change that? So that
communicate step by step. Now, the thing is, in the days when the Beatles had to make, you know, they had to work 10 years to make it that much, you know. But in the age of Mary Hopkins, you know, she had to work for a month or something, she made it, you know. You know, the communication media is getting so expanded, you know, that now it's easier for one person to communicate with the whole world than ever before. And this communication media is going to be more and more expanded, so the world is going to be smaller and smaller in result of it, and it'll be easier and easier for people to communicate. So the more we communicate, there'll be one day the whole world, you know, with mental telepathy or whatever, would boom, communicate right away like that. And there'll be total communication, and after that there'll be no violence.